2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 254, Teaching Mormonism in the Catholic Classroom, a paper by Matthew Smalls, with a response by Richard Sherlock.
They have on, so as not to disturb us. Be grateful. Anything that makes noise. Welcome to Session 254 of Sunstone Symposium, August 2004 in Salt Lake City. The featured paper at this session is entitled Teaching Mormonism in the Catholic Classroom. The presenter is Dr. Matthew Smalls. He received his BA from Amherst College and PhD in the History of Religions from the Divinity School of the University of Chicago. He is presently an Edward Bennett Williams Fellow and Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. The respondent will be Dr. Richard Sherlock. He has two graduate degrees from Harvard in theology and philosophy, and he is presently a professor at Utah State University. But pursuant to this presentation, he was a professor of moral philosophy at Fordham University, a Jesuit school in New York City. I say a university to make that distinction. And he has presented at Sunstone since 1985. We'll now hear from Dr. Smalls.
I don't usually speak with a microphone, so if I get too loud, please tell me. It's really nice to be here. The teaching and study of religion, I have found, is often dominated by implicit assumptions about what constitutes normal or healthy religiosity. In the many institutions that offer courses in religious studies, Hinduism, Islam, Buddhism would be placed under the rubric of world religions, while Christianity, in its various mainline Protestant and Catholic versions, would often be taught as theology. Religious traditions that are perceived as quote-unquote other, either because of their claims about the world or because of the character or number of their adherents, are often lumped together in courses that examine quote-unquote cults or sects. While the Latter-day Saint tradition has a broad temporal and geographical sweep, in many religious studies curricula, Mormonism and Mormons themselves are indeed labeled as other. Interesting, perhaps, in the claims they make about the world, but only finally of scholarly significance for what their history can tell us about the development of new religions, or perhaps the development of the American West, or sometimes about American religiosity as a whole. The tendency to relegate the Latter-day Saint tradition to a tangential scholarly space can be especially pronounced in institutions that themselves embrace a Christian religious identity. After all, the Latter-day Saint tradition does indeed claim to be a restoration of the Judeo-Christian tradition, a claim that many other Christian denominations, whether Catholic or Protestant, would vigorously contest as they themselves assert their own claims to attention and authority. In what follows, I'd like to share with all of you my reflections on teaching Mormonism in a Catholic liberal arts college that embraces the Jesuit tradition in higher education. And I'd like to specifically share with all of you not only my pedagogical strategy for teaching the Latter-day Saint tradition, but also how the largely Catholic students in the class engage the diversity of Mormonism and the discourse surrounding it. And to conclude, I'll offer some more general reflections on how Mormonism can be taught or could be taught in the Catholic classroom, not as a religious tradition that is other or heretical, but as a tradition that both complements and challenges the Catholic tradition in a variety of ways. Before moving forward, I'd like to add the caveat that I'm not an expert on Mormonism, and while I've published in the area of American religiosity, my primary area of expertise is, interestingly enough, the religions of South Asia, particularly Christianity in South Asia, where I lived and worked for 4 years as a student and researcher. And while I'm Roman Catholic myself and have received training in Catholic theology, my scholarly methodology is religio-historical and ethnographic. And so my comments today with all of you are intended to be provisional and open to amendment, correction, and challenge, hopefully with all of your help after I finish my formal remarks. So I teach in the Religious Studies Department at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, some 40 miles west of Boston. In part to escape anti-Catholic sentiment in Boston, the Archbishop of Boston established the College of the Holy Cross way back in 1843 and entrusted it to the Society of Jesus, or the Jesuits as they are more commonly known. Holy Cross, of course, has changed over the years, reflecting changes in Catholic educational institutions throughout the United States. For example, today, Jesuit clerics and Catholic lay people, such as myself, are a minority among teaching faculty, even though the vast majority of Holy Cross's 2,700 students identify themselves as Catholics. While students are required to take one class in religious studies, this class need not concern the Catholic tradition and need not concern theology. And one certainly does not need to be Catholic in order to teach in the religious studies department. And, of course, there is no formal assent to core elements in Catholic doctrine required of Catholic faculty members in religious studies, although some of you might be aware that this is a matter of some debate within the Catholic tradition at this moment. And so the curriculum at Holy Cross, both within religious studies and the college as a whole, is in many ways similar to that found at secular liberal arts schools, although the Jesuit mission and identity institution does shape the life of the college in powerful and unmistakable ways. And so it was in this context that I offered a course in modern religious movements in which 30 students enrolled. Several years earlier, I had taught modern religious movements as a seminar and foregrounded the discussion of the Latter-day Saint tradition. I began with Fawn Brodie's No Man Knows My History. And as all of you, I'm sure, much more aware than I am, Brodie's work is quite controversial. Some scholars working in the field of American religiosity still consider it a classic or the definitive work on Mormonism, while others, and obviously not just Latter-day Saints, find it deeply flawed. Students' collective reaction to Brodie's treatment of Joseph Smith was encapsulated well by one student who observed, quote, "I'm glad there weren't historians and journalists who approached Jesus in this way a century following his death," close quote. And so I'd hope that my inclusion in this original course of Jan Schiff's Insightful Study Mormonism would counterbalance Brodie's work, especially in Schiff's compelling discussion of how narratives from the Hebrew Bible shaped the Latter-day Saints' understanding of their exodus to Utah. I found, however, that Schiff's discussion might be better suited to a more advanced class or as a culminating work in a much more in-depth discussion of the Latter-day Saint tradition. And so when planning a revised version of modern religious movements for a larger group of students, I chose a different tact. Instead of introducing the course through Mormonism, I saved Mormonism to the very end. I structured the syllabus around a critical consideration of themes within the discourse surrounding new and alternative religions. The category cult, quote-unquote, brainwashing, charismatic leadership, disconfirmation of prophecy, and violence. These overall theoretical issues frame the discussion of specific modern religious movements such as Scientology, the Unification Church, the Children of God, the Watchtower, and the Branch Davidians. But the driving pedagogical question behind the course was to examine contemporary discourse surrounding cults and to probe the implicit standards behind such discourse. In this effort, I also included a discussion of various Catholic groups that have been characterized as cults in order to force students to reflect on how, quote-unquote, or what I would call cult discourse, might apply to religious practices that they as Catholic students would find more familiar. And I'm sure, as many of you know, both Catholicism and Mormonism are considered to be cults by evangelical Protestant groups. For example, if you, for whatever reason, go to the website of Bob Jones University, you'll find that Catholicism and Mormonism are both labeled as cults that the Christian church has to fight against. So Mormons and Catholics should at least share that in common. So I decided to engage the Latter-day Saint tradition as the culmination of the class to bring together many of the theoretical issues elicited by the course. So I began our discussion of Mormonism with the first chapter from Klaus Hansen's book, Mormonism and the American Experience, that succinctly overviews the birth of Mormonism and particularly draws attention to how the Book of Mormon, within the context of its time, was perceived as something eminently rational, which certainly did not contradict most of the scientific knowledge as it was understood at that time. Students found this argument compelling, as they did Hansen's discussion of Joseph Smith as a quote-unquote genius, not unlike Mozart or Darwin or Marx. Students, however, were less impressed by Hansen's use of the quote-unquote bicameral brain hypothesis to account for the psychology of Joseph Smith. The bicameral brain, it was an idea advanced by the psychologist Julian James that posits that the human mind is divided into separate parts, and so it's possible theoretically for these two parts to interact in a way that the person is not aware of, and this can manifest itself as what is perceived as external voices or visions. Many students interpreted Hansen's allusion to the bicameral mind as a way of having one's cake and eating it too, not in a way dissimilar to how a Catholic scholar, such as myself, might use psychoanalytic methodology to explain the vision of a mystic. It's unfortunate that Hansen's Mormonism in the American experience is now out of print, at least according to my investigation, for it would have made a fine foundational text for the course. But after giving a very general introduction to the beginnings of Mormonism, I had students engage a work that is far more polemical than Fawn Brodie's No Man Knows My History. The next book I assigned was John Krakauer's Under the Banner of Heaven, The Story of a Violent Faith. The intent behind having students read Krakauer was not to achieve some sort of unbiased explication of the Latter-day Saint tradition. Instead, it was to draw students into a discussion of Mormonism by having them reflect upon the implicit assumptions that shape Krakauer's discussion of what he calls a violent faith. As I'm sure all of you know, Krakauer focuses on murders committed by Ron and Dan Lafferty, whom he describes as Mormon fundamentalists, because of their practice of polygamy and expansive claims of prophetic discernment. And so in order to unpack the specifics of the case, Krakauer draws upon key elements from what could be best described as anti-Mormon polemics. He talks about blood atonement, polygamy, the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and other elements and events associated with Mormonism that have been long standard fare in classifying Mormonism as a cult or a Christian heresy. The students in the Modern Religious Movements course were initially drawn to Krakauer's journalistic style and his sensationalistic subject matter. With specific regard to polygamy, however, many students who had taken a comparative religions course that I teach commented that polygamy is permitted in Islam and many other religious traditions, and so it's not perhaps as sensational as Krakauer might conventionally think. While students had a variety of reactions to Krakauer's discussion, the most interesting discussion crystallized around his analysis of the Elizabeth Smart case. The last time I came to Salt Lake City, in fact, the search for Elizabeth Smart was underway, and most students in my class were well aware of the general outlines of her case. And so, as all of you, I'm sure, know, Elizabeth Smart was abducted by Brian David Mitchell, who was deeply influenced by strains within what Krakauer again calls Mormon fundamentalism. But Krakauer focuses not only on the worldview of Mitchell as a kidnapper, but also of Elizabeth Smart herself. And in specific regard to Elizabeth Smart, Krakauer observes, quote, "Raised to obey figures of Mormon authority unquestionably, and to believe that LDS doctrine is the law of God, she would have been particularly susceptible to the dexterous fundamentalist spin Mitchell applied to familiar Mormon scripture. The white robes Mitchell and Barzee wore and forced Elizabeth to wear resembled the sacred robes she had donned with her family when she entered the Mormon temple. When Mike Mitchell bullied Elizabeth into submitting to his carnal demands, he used the words of Joseph Smith, words she had been taught were handed down by God himself, to phrase those demands. Being brought up as she was made her especially vulnerable," says Debbie Palmer, who is intimately acquainted with the coercive power of fundamentalist culture from her own upbringing in Bountiful. Mitchell would have never had such a power over a non-Mormon girl." Close quote. Many students were taken aback by Krakauer's analysis, which gave them considerable pause. Some students seem to think that Krakauer's analysis of Elizabeth Smart's mindset followed quite well from his account of the Mormon tradition. Furthermore, Krakauer's focus on what he portrays as the sexual appetites of Joseph Smith seemed to prefigure not only the acts of Mitchell, Lafferty, and others on the fringe of Mormonism, but also the Latter-day Saint tradition as a whole. But such students who found Krakauer's discussion compelling were in a distinct minority. Instead, most students found Krakauer's analysis not only inappropriately sensationalist, but also a disturbing example of what I have called cult discourse. Many students understood Krakauer's approach to be premised upon particular understandings of authority and the effects of submission to authority. Krakauer draws attention to the centrality of authority within the LDS worldview and to the LDS church itself and the way it's structured. Coupled with this is an understanding of prophecy, which Krakauer, as many students thought, seems to argue lends itself to a grandiosity that can even justify murder, whether in Mountain Meadows or in Utah County. Students in modern religious movements, quite correctly in my view, understood Krakauer to be saying essentially that Elizabeth Smart, as well as many other LDS women, are in some ways programmed or even brainwashed to accepting male authority. The case of Elizabeth Smart then becomes not a terrible story about how a disturbed man used power and force to rape a young woman, Instead, the story of Elizabeth Smart for Krakauer encapsulates the tensions and indeed the pathologies of Mormonism as a whole. In recognizing Krakauer's polemical and sensationalist approach to the LDS tradition, students were able to make a particularly interesting connection to contemporary discourse surrounding Roman Catholicism, particularly in the wake of the sexual abuse crisis. I'm sure all of you are well aware of the real crisis within American Catholicism that has arisen with revelations that priests who were sexual abusers were kept in ministry and effectively shuttled from parish to parish by their bishops. I live in Massachusetts, which has been the epicenter of the crisis, and a crisis which has continued even after the resignation of Bernard Cardinal Law. I myself was interviewed by the Boston Globe about the international ramifications of the sexual abuse scandal. But the Globe, when they talked to me, seemed more interested in me giving them more examples of sexual transgressions by Catholic priests in India and Africa, which is my sort of cultural field of expertise, which is to say that they really wanted dirt from me and not too much analysis. Students in the modern religious movements class argue that Krakauer's discussion of Mormon fundamentalism was in many ways structurally similar to critiques of the Catholic Church for the sexual abuse crisis. If for Krakauer, Mormons are in some ways pre-programmed to be subordinate to authority, so too are many Catholics, at least according to many accounts, even in the mainstream media. If for Krakauer, there are various sexual pathologies in Mormonism reflected in the persistence of polygamy, then there are various sexual pathologies found in Catholicism, especially because of its valorization of celibacy. One of the interesting characteristics of the discourse surrounding the sexual abuse crisis in the Catholic Church is how various groups have drawn different lessons from it. For many Catholic conservatives, the Church has become too liberal or too tolerant. For many Catholic liberals, however, the crisis shows that the Church is too intolerant, too hierarchical, too authoritarian, and so forth. In either case, however, the sexual abuse crisis is revelatory of the fundamental essence of Catholicism. Likewise, for Krakauer, the kidnapping of Elizabeth Smart or the practice of polygamy among those excommunicated by the LDS Church somehow becomes emblematic of the essential nature of the LDS tradition. What happens in both cases is that the diversity of experience and practice in both traditions is set aside in an effort to develop a kind of monumental or exemplary history that serves an inherently polemical point of view. So the effect of reading Krakauer's Under the Banner of Heaven was to break through the common prejudices that often color perceptions of the LDS Church and the Latter-day Saints themselves. By making a connection between the discourse surrounding Mormonism and Catholicism, students were able to find a common ground between themselves and Mormons, who are often portrayed as Catholics are, with broad and prejudiced brushstrokes. And so our discussions of the LDS tradition move through Douglas J. Davies' book, An Introduction to Mormonism. Davies, as I'm sure many of you know, is a British academic who is not Mormon himself, but he presents a theologically sophisticated discussion of the LDS tradition that takes seriously its distinctiveness from and continuity with conventional Christianity. There are a variety of themes within the LDS worldview that Davies emphasizes. Chief among these are the Mormon emphasis upon agency and activity, and his understanding of salvation as a continuing process of joyful labor. What was most compelling, however, for students was Davies' argument that for Latter-day Saints, and you all can tell me whether this is an accurate characterization, that for Latter-day Saints, it is Jesus' experience in Gethsemane, not his crucifixion, that is essential to understanding his nature as Christ. Davies gives an example of how LDS thinkers have reflected that Jesus himself experienced a kind of cosmic battle within his own psyche as he asserted his own agency to do God's will. For my Catholic students, this view resonated with Catholic emphasis not only upon the sufferings of Christ, but also upon what's been called the dark night of the soul, which is considered to be an essential element in Catholic mystical development. Of course, Davies also discusses the LDS tripartite understanding of the afterlife, which some students thought to be an interesting expression of what's been called the Indo-European tendency to divide everything into three parts, an aspect of Indo-European thought that scholars have identified in ancient India, Iran, as well as Western Europe. Students also found strong parallels between Mormon understandings of endowment rituals and Catholic sacraments. For Catholics, as I'm sure some of you know, sacraments such as baptism, the ordination of priests, marriage, or the Eucharist, the celebration of the Last Supper, are not just rituals that have a symbolic import. Instead, they affect what they symbolize through an infusion of grace. Students discerned a similar, generally similar, dynamic in the LDS celebration of marriage for time and eternity, in the household blessing, and indeed in the special endowment garb worn by Mormons during temple rituals. For both traditions, there's an emphasis not only on the ritual transmission of supernatural gifts, but also upon the human being as a union of soul and body. But perhaps what struck students most was the Mormon emphasis upon community. In addition to Davies' work, students read an article by Mario DePellis, published in Sunstone several years ago, that describes the persistence of the Mormon community in the tight and almost mystical communal bonds fostered by the LDS Church. Our discussion of the LDS tradition did not focus exclusively on secondary works, although these were certainly necessary to place Mormonism in context. Correlated with specific sections of Davies' work, students read primary texts. From the Book of Mormon, we read the vision of the Tree of Life and the Rod of Iron from the first book of Nephi. We read sections from Doctrines and Covenants, including Joseph Smith's prophecies concerning polygamy, the coming of the Civil War, and his proclamation of the Word of Wisdom. We also read Gordon Hinckley's speech given soon after the 9/11 attacks, in which he articulates quite clearly, at least from my reading of it, the sense of millennial expectation that underlies the LDS worldview. It was through engaging the specificity of primary LDS texts that students were also introduced to very real points of doctrinal disagreement between Mormonism and Catholicism. Issues concerning the Trinity, the status of God and his physicality, the notion of prophecy and prophethood are indeed very real issues of difference between the LDS and Catholic traditions. These points of difference have led many to label Mormonism as a new religion that is not in reality Christian. This, however, was not the conclusion drawn by the students in the course that I taught. The focus of the class certainly was not to engage the LDS tradition theologically or to evaluate its claims. Instead, it was to try, in inevitably limited and partial way, to understand how the LDS tradition views the lives of believers with meaning. In planning the course, I had assumed that Mormonism would be considered different, other, or perhaps even bizarre from a conventional Catholic perspective. But as the course progressed, it was clear that this was not the case, and not because of anything that I did personally as a teacher. Instead, many of my students in the class had grown up with Mormon friends, particularly in Belmont, Massachusetts, and surrounding towns where there is a substantial LDS community. For these students, Mormons were not others, but friends, and indeed fellow brothers and sisters in Christ. The discussion of the LDS tradition in the Modern Religious Movements course I taught was preliminary and general. And to conclude the formal elements of my talk this afternoon, I'd like to chart a general outline of what I would call more robust engagement between the LDS and Catholic traditions. If I were to organize a course that would more fully engage the two traditions in comparison, I would focus on particular themes that animate the religious beliefs and practices of both Mormons and Catholics. The first of these themes is authority. One of the central elements in both Catholicism and Mormonism that draws deep suspicion and criticism from the surrounding culture is the emphasis upon authority. Within Catholicism, authority is transferred through apostolic succession, holy orders, and of course the Pope exists as the vicar of Christ on earth. Within the LDS Church, there is a generally similar emphasis upon authority, and particularly the need of a central authority to adjudicate doctrinal issues. Both Mormonism and Catholicism are patriarchal in their structure, and only men have full access to religiously sanctioned authority. Even though both traditions, and this is very important to recognize, have significant female presence and participation in religious life. In my discussion with students in the modern religious movements, however, it was the LDS Church, and I would like your input on this, that emerged in their view as having the greater institutional and religious means of adapting to a changing world. That is, the LDS Church seemed to my students to be more flexible than the Catholic Church. And clearly, the Mormon understanding of prophecy, as it's invested in the First Presidency and can be exercised by Mormons within the appropriate context, can, at least potentially, become a powerful means for adaptation or for a progressive understanding of God's involvement in the world, as evidenced by how the LDS Church has indeed changed and developed over time. A second crucial thing that I would articulate in such a course is what I would call embodiment. If you read scholarship on religion nowadays, if you have a lot of free time and stuff like that, especially work done by PhDs like me, a lot of it focuses on embodiment. And embodiment can mean a lot of things. It can mean the importance of the human body, for example, or how, or for understanding the body as a crucial index of one's orientation in the world. So you look at the body as somehow symbolic of a tradition's overall orientation and view of the world. And clearly within the LDS tradition, as I understand it, the body is central. The prescriptions of the Word of Wisdom have to do with the body, at least in some form, as do various ritual endowments. And all this is subsumed, as I understand it, within an understanding of the person as a combination of spirit and body unified by the soul. And in Mormonism as well, there sometimes can be an emphasis upon a particular way of presenting the body. And one can see this perhaps in Mormon missionaries or also in athletics. My home institution, the College of the Holy Cross, has one of its claims to fame, the only basketball team from New England ever to win the NCAA Division I basketball championship. But that was a long time ago, but they're still talking about it. For Catholics, especially several decades ago, athletics became a way of articulating a kind of Catholic religious vision of discipline and collective action. And so while Christianity is often characterized as dualistic, relying upon a distinction between the soul and the body, Catholicism has a much more unified understanding of the body as an index of the condition of the soul. And so in both Catholicism and Mormonism, embodiment, in its most specific and most abstract forms, is central to articulating a particular religious vision. Finally, there's the theme of meaning, or more simply, how each tradition is able to imbue the lives of believers with meaning. What has always struck me about Mormonism and Catholicism, at least in some of their forms, is a dual emphasis upon will or agency, that is action, and also surrender. For both traditions, there's an understanding of what could be called conquest that is achieved only by a disciplined human agency or disciplined human power, but also through surrender to God and to appropriate authority. And in both traditions as well, and this is also very important, and I'm learning more about this as I attend this conference, there are ways in which people resist this combination of will, surrender, and authority in quite powerful ways. In the end, any course that engages the breadth of human religiosity needs to be sensitive to difference, diversity, and variation. One of the crucial mistakes that commentators on both Mormonism and Catholicism have made is to consider each tradition as monolithic, undifferentiated, or an undifferentiated whole. But the power of Mormonism and Catholicism is that they work on a variety of levels and speak to people in powerful and yet different ways. The outline I presented of my class on Mormonism is simply that, an outline, a partial and limited engagement with an infinitely rich and powerful tradition. And the effort to improve and deepen my understanding of the Mormon tradition has brought me here to be with all of you today. And so I'm very grateful for the patience and attention you have brought to my remarks. Thank you.
I enjoyed that paper immensely. I thought it had a lot of insights that we should all consider and think about. In my remarks on the general idea, trying to compare Catholicism and Mormonism, I want to make four general points. First is that Mormonism has no formal or fixed theology. The issues that in the sweep of the Christian tradition and the Catholic tradition have divided churches, created sects, split what was once a unified Christianity, first into Eastern Christianity and Western Catholicism, and then into the Reformation. All of those issues, Mormonism has no fixed theology on. The best place to see that is to look at the Encyclopedia of Mormonism. On all of the key theological issues on which you'd say, well, you know, Mormonism believes this, many Mormons believe something and other Mormons don't. Nature of the Trinity, the nature of God, omniscience and human freedom, the whole series of issues, Mormonism has no fixed theology. My second point, and I think that's unlike Roman Catholicism, which has on a lot of issues a fixed reference point, though I'm not saying all Catholics agree with that, and all Catholic theologians don't. From one who was at one point teacher of theology. I was a professor of moral theology at Fordham University. The second point I'd like to make is that I think from an ecclesiology standpoint, from the standpoint of the understanding of the of church, Mormonism represents an attempt to hold together the Catholic emphasis on an authoritative, what Catholics would call magisterium, an authoritative church structure with a fixed head and fixed organization from the Pope to the bishops to the priests to the congregant. And then the Pope has various congregations which advise him on various matters, and sometimes the leaders of those congregations are at least as influential as the Pope in defining doctrine. You know, some years ago, the Mormon Church had this Committee on Strengthening Members, which was an attempt to enforce doctrinal purity. Well, the Committee on Strengthening Members has nothing over the sacred congregation in Rome, headed by Cardinal Ratzinger. You want to see somebody who will enforce doctrine? Cardinal Ratzinger knows how to do it. But there's this emphasis, authoritative teaching magisterium, combined with the emphasis that comes out of the left wing of the Reformation. The Baptist movements. Mormonism has never really been influenced by Quakerism, which was a later adjunct out of the left wing of the Reformation. But there's this emphasis that comes out of the Baptist and Anabaptist movements on personal moral energy, personal moral righteousness. Symbolized in Mormonism by the fact that Mormonism has rejected infant baptism. And in the long history of Christian theology, infant baptism is one of the cutting issues that most people don't realize how cutting that is and how important that is to your understanding of church. The rejection of infant baptism. So, my second point is this, the Mormonism represents an attempt to bring the Catholic magisterium together with the emphasis on personal moral righteousness and personal moral energy and regeneration that comes really out of the Baptist Anabaptist movements of what George Huntston Williams called the Radical Reformation. My third and fourth point go together. But my third point is that the essence of Mormonism is the doctrine of continuous divine revelation. Now, compare that with Roman Catholicism, because Roman Catholicism has a doctrine, has a teaching. It's relatively new. It's only 130 some odd years old, officially, but looks somewhat similar. The doctrine of papal infallibility, which was announced at the First Vatican Council. And the great Catholic, 19th century English Catholic thinker, Lord Acton, thought that was a bad doctrine and said, well, when the First Vatican Council announced and the Pope accepted the doctrine of papal infallibility, Acton said, well, the Pope can change his religion, but I'm not changing mine. But the doctrine of papal infallibility is that under the right conditions, the Pope can, by the grace of God, announce a teaching about faith or morals, which is holy without error. Now that looks suspiciously like the notion that sometimes God can tell President Hinckley, thus saith the Lord, and this is what the new teaching is. But here's the difference. Though they look structurally similar, they are light years apart. Because in Roman Catholicism, There is a rich and precise set of tests that you can that you are to apply. It's in canon law. Rich, precise set of tests that you apply to a papal pronouncement to determine whether it is announced inerrantly or not. I mean, it's a really precise set of tests. And there is a debate, in fierce debate among theologians, to some extent about whether these are the right tests or not. But that's a debate among canon lawyers that, you know, would beat Simonex 10-1. Where the action is among moral theologians, because that's where the action is whether any particular papal doctrine is announced inerrantly. Humanae Vitae on contraception, or earlier pronouncements about specific and really controversial sorts of talk. Fierce debate about that. The interesting thing is that Mormonism, though it has a doctrine of continuous divine revelation, has none of that discussion about, you know, precisely when is the prophet speaking to the prophet. We say a prophet is only a prophet when he's speaking as a prophet. Okay. Now, when is that? Tell me. I want to know. Gee, if he's speaking as a prophet, that's something I ought to know. When? Give me the test. Roman Catholicism gives you a specific set of tests. We have none of that. We say, what do we say to our believers? To people like me who are, you know, deeply committed Mormons? Pray about it, and you will receive the answer to your direct soul whether or not the prophet is speaking as a prophet. You pray about it. And that leads to my fourth point, and then we'll have some time for some questions. One way that I would introduce the difference between Mormonism and Roman Catholicism and the comparisons is with where most people live in their religion. That is ethics. Your grandmother is 94. She lies in a hospital bed. She has had a stroke. She may need to be on a respirator. She probably almost certainly is on IV fluids. She may need a feeding tube. And the doctor comes out and talks to the family and lays out the situation and asks the family, if she goes into cardiac arrest, should we try to resuscitate her? Should we keep her on a respirator? Should we keep her on a feeding tube? And a whole series of other things. Should we do this? Should we do this? If the family is Roman Catholic and they turn to their priest for guidance, their priest can draw upon literally thousands of pages of rich, precise analysis of those questions. What to do, what not to do. There are authoritative, I'm not saying inerrant, authoritative declarations on those issues from the Vatican, from national Catholic bodies, from the National Conference of Catholic Bishops, from conservative theologians, some of whom I know well, from moderate theologians, from more liberal theologians. But it's a rich, precise, and in some ways, if you're in this field as I am, you just stand in awe of the richness and the precision of people thinking from within a theological context in which life is a sacred gift from God. How do you think about that in this situation with the grandmother? And the priest has that rich, precise body of literature to draw upon to advise and it will make in Roman Catholicism a profound moral difference whether what you're talking about is taking away a respirator and taking away a feeding tube. That is a distinction that is enormously significant, and there are reasons for that, and I could give you an argument. The family is Mormon. They turn to their bishop. Their bishop has none of that discussion. None of that body of literature to draw upon. Nothing. Nada. This is a situation that is faced by families every day. By Mormon families. Every day. Families are going through this situation right now, today, as I'm talking, in hospitals all up and down the Mormon corridor from Idaho Falls to Mason. And we have none of that discussion. None. And we have no inclination to develop it. I mean, we have people who could develop that. From a more orthodox position, Apostle Nelson has undoubtedly been in this situation thousands of times, doing cardiothoracic surgery and coming out and saying, you know, we did the best we could, but, you know, your grandmother is going to be, you know, totally disabled for the last while in her life. No inclination to develop this. And what, again, do we tell our members to do? You know your grandmother better than anybody else. You have the priesthood. But really, it's you know your grandmother better than anybody else. You have... You don't need to turn to theologians for advice. Because you, personally, can turn to the source of all wisdom. Yourself. You don't need theologians. People like me to interfere with that. What you need to do is think about the options in the best way you can, and then get on your knees and ask the source of all wisdom. And that is profoundly different than Roman Catholicism. Because Mormonism doesn't have a doctrine of natural law norms that philosophers and people like me love to play with. So I think this notion that we don't have the very structures for understanding when a prophet is a prophet and how to wrestle with these moral questions shows the connection and the difference between Mormonism and Roman Catholicism. Thank you.
We have about 7 or 8 minutes left for questions. Those of you who have questions would come up to the microphone and repeat them into the, well, microphone so that everyone can know the question when they listen to the tape.
I enjoyed the paper very much, Dr. Schmaltz. Very interesting. I wonder if you could comment on the class in terms of what was the genesis of this? Was it your idea? Did a department assigned this to you? Was it, you know, were there concerns they had about teaching a class on Mormonism at your school? How many students, you know, signed up? I'm interested in those sorts of practical details.
Yeah, it was my idea.
You come to the mic.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Microphone thing. Yeah. It was my idea, and there were no concerns about it.
But I think it'll be interesting, since I'd like to write about this experience, what they will think when I come up for my tenure review of putting Mormonism in dialogue with Catholicism, not just sort of seeing Mormonism as something out there, other, strange. I think students really appreciated that, because it allowed them also to look at their I give my report about coming here and engaging in sort of Mormon Catholic dialogue. But for me and for the students, it was a wonderful experience. And 30 students, 100 students enrolled for the course, but I could only have 30. So it was something that did strike a nerve with a lot of people, I think.
I'm sorry I graduated from Utah State University earlier because I wish I were there to take class on the UN. It was an agricultural college when I was there. I guess my question is this. I remember a while back when the president of the LDS Church was on 60 Minutes, and he was asked a question about the Mormon belief of they could become a god. And if you remember his answer, it was, well, I don't know, we don't talk much about that. That was his answer on national TV. That was very disturbing to me, extremely disturbing to me, because I always thought in my mind, the one main reason I stayed active a Mormon, because I could become a god. And if that isn't true, or if the president of the church wasn't willing to stand up to that philosophy or that policy or that prophecy or whatever I'm trying to say, then the whole movement was put into question. Well, I started wondering then, really, what can we accept as the canon of the Mormon church? It would be nice to know, really, when I say I'm a Mormon, what I stand for. Would you like to address that?
Do I need to come up there? They're taping this. I want to go on record.
Oh, go on record.
I think the essence of Mormonism can be boiled down to one belief. Continuous divine revelation. Two, for the church as a whole, and equally importantly, to each individual believer. That is the core of Mormonism. And that's symbolized, and I'll say this later in a panel, in the Book of Mormon. That's Book of Mormon is a symbol of that. But it isn't the end of that. And the rest of it is simply add-ons.
Just one more. I'm very strict.
You know, after pondering this question that I just asked in my own mind, I guess I come up with the thought that if you ask the Mormon hierarchy what is the canon of the Mormon Church, they would tell you the Doctrine of Covenants. D&C, you know. That's a record of the revelation, supposedly to the prophets of old, not so much new. Then came the question, the Mormon Church had a revelation that polygamy should no longer be practiced by the Mormon Church. We know why, because they're threatened to take their property away and they couldn't become a state here. Section 132 of the Doctrine and Covenants was the part of the Mormon canon that authorized polygamy. Guess where it is? Still there. Why?
I'd like to thank the presenters for their remarks, and it's so interesting. I was a Catholic for 20 years as an adult, 10 of those years in a monastic community, and I've been a Mormon for 15 years. I'm very glad to be a Mormon, but one of the things that I'd like to ask you to say something about is, on the one hand, personal will and free agency versus conscience, because I'm sometimes troubled. As a Catholic, so much emphasis was put on developing your individual conscience through study but in prayer, and then that was the bottom line. Nothing trumped conscience. And I don't have that same sense as a Mormon in terms of personal agency. I feel that you never even hear the word conscience, or that personal agency is the bottom line.
I just find it really fascinating that, you know, in listening to your comments, there seems to be what's reflected in Mormonism is the same kind of tension, well, not the same kind, but a very similar tension that one finds in Catholicism. You know, hearing Richard's remarks, for example, I was thinking, you know, okay, well, then on what basis would someone from who teaches at BYU be removed of a position, or on what basis would anyone in authority have to excommunicate someone? But, of course, that does happen. And so you find the same thing in Catholicism. I mean, there is this sense of personal conscience that's very, very strong, and most of my colleagues would say that that is, you know, the criterion for making a moral decision. But I think when you were exposed to that was, you know, probably immediately following the Second Vatican Council, in which there was this kind of explosion of kind of rethinking, you know, the Catholic worldview, either challenging the traditional Catholic worldview or moving it within continuity. I know, for example, the bishop in the diocese where I teach would have a very circumscribed view of the way in which people can use their individual conscience, and would not sort of buy someone saying, well, I'm going to practice artificial birth control because I've examined it in my conscience. So I think there are a lot of interesting issues that both Catholics and Mormons can talk about in terms of how these authority versus conscience is balanced.
I know this has to be our last comment, so I'll be brief. In Roman the answer to your to respond to your thing about excommunication in Mormonism is traditionally been reserved for some sorts of grievous sexual sins, adultery, though less so now than before. But primarily it's been, if you challenge the hierarchy, if the hierarchy says don't get into this topic and you get into it, then that, I don't agree with that, but that I think is where it's coming from. In Roman Catholicism, coming out of St. Thomas Aquinas' text, The Disputed Questions of Truth, and it comes into the modern Roman Catholicism, there are two elements in a moral judgment. One is your knowledge of universal, general moral principles. That was called, in the medieval languages, synderesis. Now, for Mormons, that is something like the light of Christ in every man, where you know that murder is wrong, or killing is wrong, or stealing is wrong. You just know those things. And in Roman Catholicism, as traditionally Mormonism, you generally can't be in error about those things. Then conscience, or in the Latin conscientia, was the application of those general moral principles to actual cases. And there was a huge Roman Catholic literature on errors that you can make in applying the principle to the cases. And Mormonism doesn't have a discussion of that, but we go through that. Mormon has a doctrine of conscience, which is applying those things everybody knows to the actual specific cases. And that's a very difficult process of applying those things. Mormonism struggles with those, as does all of humanity.
Would it be all right if we went a little over time? All right. Please come up and ask your question.
I want to thank you both speakers today. What I have to say is, because I'm writing a dissertation on Mormonism and Catholicism, and also because I'm a canon lawyer and a Roman Catholic priest, so it's very difficult for me just to shut up today at that particular moment. But I just wanted to, I admire the work you do in your college. I think that's wonderful. I want to do just one clarification in reference to Dr. Sherlock's points on Mormonism and Catholicism. He mentioned the issue of infallibility. So we have to remember that the Pope is infallible only when he speaks ex cathedra. That means when he speaks on matters of doctrine from the chair of Peter. The Pope can speak on political issues, you know, social justice, education, and he can be wrong. That's why the Church has to develop and advance to the world. And that's why your students feel that the Mormon Church is more adapted to the world, because the speed that the Catholic Church uses is different. So I just wanted to make that clarification, and I thank you to both of you.
We will now close the session. Thank you very much for coming. And tapes of this session will be available in the lobby a few hours